So this week's Sedra, Parshas Nosoi, begins Vayedaber Hashem Moshe Lemoy. God spoke to Moshe saying, Nosoi es Rosh B'nei Gershon Gam Heim, count also the heads of the tribe of Gershon, the family of Gershon, the Beis Avosam, to their father's house, to Mishpachosam, their families, Ben Shloshim Shonu V'mala, from the age of 30 and up, everybody comes to join in the hosts that serve the temple. You know, last week we began the book of Numbers. It's called the book of Numbers, or in the Gemara it's called Chomish Pikudim, the book that deals with the census. And we took account of the Jewish people, and it came to 600,000 and some. But the tribe of Levi was not counted among them. So the 12 tribes are actually made up of Menashe and Ephraim, who replace Yosef and Levi. So now, in this week's Seder, God says to Moshe, now you have to count the tribe of Levi separately. Because Levi has been chosen with a special mission. The family of Aaron are the Kohanim, the priests, and the rest of the tribe of Levi, they have particular appointments. Most notably is the making of the music, the blowing of the horn, and all the musical accompaniment that went with the temple service, and every sacrifice and every act of worship had its own accompaniment. Besides that, the tribe of Levi is also commanded to assemble and disassemble the tabernacle itself. The word tabernacle means a building that can be broken down into its components and reassembled again. And that was the Mishkan, the dwelling place of the Shekhinah, that the Jewish people were commanded to make, which takes up most of the book, or the latter half of the book of Exodus. So the families of the tribe of Levi are divided into three: Gershon, Kohath, and Merari. And each of them has a different appointment. The children of Kohath, they carry the Aron, the ark in which the Ten Commandments are held, and the Menorah, the Shulchan, the table, and the incense altar, and various other of the sacred accoutrements of the tabernacle. And the tribe, the family of Gershon, they carry the Urios, which are the tapestries that made up the roof and hang down over the walls, and the curtains and the hooks that bound these things together. And then Merari carry the planks, the wooden staves and the guy ropes and things like that, from which the actual skeleton of the tabernacle was assembled. The Ishbitz, as we've said 100 times, in Ishbitz, the Torah is eternal. There's nothing, that was applicable 2,500, 3,000 years ago. There's no such thing in Ishbitz. The Torah is eternal, or it's meaningless, right? So the fact that Moshe is commanded to count the families of these three parts of the tribe of Levi, and that seems to be such a long time ago, doesn't make any difference. Everything that happens here in the Sedra applies to each Jew individually. So each of us we have inside us the tabernacle, and we also have inside us the families of Gershon, Kohath, and Merari. So with that, knowing that in Ishbitz the Torah is eternal and everything has to apply to every Jew at every time, we come back to the Seder and we look at it fresh. So he says, "Hine b'zeh Seder, in this portion, nizbag ma'amukim shehoi olav rotzen Hashem." You know, the world, we've learned many times that there are three components, three Kabbalistic components to the universe: olam, nefesh, and shono. That is, there is a universe in time, there's a universe in space, and there's a universe in the individual soul. And that they reflect one another, and they are reflected in the body, and they're reflected in the Jewish year, and they're reflected in the space that we occupy. And that when the three come together, you have the Holy of Holies, and you have the holy soul of the high priest, and then you have the holy moment in the middle of Yom Kippur, and the high priest representing the holy soul enters into the Holy of Holies on that holy day, right? But then each of us, we have inside us the Kohen Gadol, the high priest. Each of us is in Yom Kippur every day, and each of us is in the Holy of Holies. Again, you know, this is the Ishbitz Torah, that everything applies to everybody all the time. But here, the Ishbitz says that when the Mishkan, when this temple, tent of meeting, the tabernacle, is assembled and completed and inaugurated, then we finally have the place, a metaphorical place, that represents the expression of divine desire. This is the place that God wants, even though, of course, the whole universe is the place that God wants. But we see that there's a process in the evolution of space and time and humanity. There is this evolution that everything passes through like a bottleneck. And whereas you have, you know, things are very broad, they become very narrow. And so for a time, you know, everything passes through, you know, Avraham Yitzchak Yaakov and Sarah Rivka Rachel Leah. It's like almost the entire universe passes through these few people and begins to spread out again. And everything passes through the Torah and through the Jewish people at Sinai, and everything passes through the land of Israel and through the Jewish people who are living there, keeping the Torah. And then everything spreads out again. And it's like history comes together into the eye of the needle. Everything has to pass through the eye of the needle, and then everything spreads out again. And this, the five books of Moshe, the Torah, really examines the historical events around nature passing through this eye of the needle, which is Jewish history, right? So, the Ishbitz says that the completion of the Mishkan and what's happening here is the expression of the space. Finally, there is this space, the Mishkan. You know, one of the last Torahs we had in the book of Exodus was an almost wistful examination of the way Moshe assembles, at the end of Parshas Pikudei, Moshe assembles the tabernacle, and each time it says it, and he did it the way he was commanded to by God. And he put the Aaron, he put the Ark into the Holy of Holies, and he put up the curtain, just like he was told to by God, and he puts the menorah and the shulchan, the table and the altar, into the sanctuary, just as he was told by God, and he assembles, and every time it says, until the final curtain goes up. And the Ishbitz notes in there, it doesn't say anymore, and he did it as he was told to by God. Because something happened as soon as the temple, as soon as this Mishkan was erected, it's that the whole world was no longer a place of prophecy. Up until that point, wherever Moshe was, he was doing things the way he had been told to by God in the wilderness. But as soon as the tabernacle is erected, then the rest of the world becomes pasul. It is excluded from the prophecy. From now on, the prophecy is going to happen there inside the temple precinct. And so as soon as Moshe put up the curtain, as soon as the final curtain went up, it was no longer the way he had been told to by God. And it's kind of like a wistful, a sense of loss, that before the Mishkan was set up, God would speak to Moshe anywhere in the world, in Egypt, in the wilderness, on the mountain, below the mountain, and in a sense that all of us, we had access to the divine wherever we were. But with the setting up of the Mishkan, then the Mishkan becomes the place. So, why is it important? Why can't we just go on the way we did, in so to speak, in primitive times, where any place was a good place to have a divine vision, a prophecy, a revelation? Why do we need this space? So the Ishbitz says, "Mi parshas Truma, shu'a scholas abinyan." If we go back into the book of Exodus to the portion where God says to Moshe, take the offerings that the Jewish people are going to bring you of gold, silver, copper, and all the various fabrics and stuff, and make me this special place. Shuas Chol HaSabin, and that's the beginning of the building of the Mishkan. Ad HaPasha Zois, until we get to this particular portion of the week, Nimtzi Yud Zayin Sedris, there are 17 portions, which is the same as the word Tov, meaning good. And it takes 17. There is an essence of goodness that we've arrived at here in this Mishkan that didn't exist before. And the Ishbita says, V'zesh Nema, this is the meaning of the verse in 2 Samuel. V'samti mokim la'am Yisrael, I'm going to give my people Israel a place. U'natativ, and I'm going to plant them. V'shochein tachtov, and then he can dwell in that place. And he will not need, or will not be vexed again. Because, with the setting up of this tabernacle, of this resting dwelling place of God, and with the encampment of the 12 tribes in their very special order of the four encampments, the different flags in which the order in that they settled around the Mishkan, to the east and the west and the north and the south. And it wasn't just coincidental. They took up the same positions around the temple in the wilderness as they had taken up around the bier on which they'd carried Jacob from Egypt to bury him in the Ma'arat HaMachpelah, in the cave of Machpelah in Hebron. He had been carried by his 12 sons. And they had prophetically taken up positions, Yehuda, Yisachar, Zvulun on one side, Reuben, Shimon, Gad on the other side, and so on, Menashe, Ephraim, and Binyamin on the left, and Dan, Naphtali, Asher in the back. And here they were surrounding the Mishkan in exactly the same order. And there's a mystical a meaning of completion that goes, we don't really have the time now to go into the readings of the Zohar and Ari, into the meanings of the encampments, but what it did is that there was a kind of a finality of a working through of many different tensions in the way that the tribes settled with each other, and the affinities that they felt among certain tribes for each other. So, with the setting up of the Mishkan, which the Mishkan was the center, the Jewish camp, the camp of the Israelites in the wilderness, was 12 square miles. It was huge, right? And in this very center was the tabernacle itself. And surrounding that were the priestly families. Moshe dwelt to the east, and next to him Aaron and his sons, and then the three Levite families on the other sides, and then in a larger square, in phalanxes on all four sides, were the other 12 tribes. And there was something about this that the Ishbitzer says, there was something about this that was a wholeness. It was complete, and it gave everybody a sense of finality. Ki b'hakom asa mishkan u'b'chaniyas ha'dgolen nikva b'lev Yisroel kedusha sh'yuchel li'moshech ha'charotzen Hashem Yisbarach. You know, we all think that doing the will of God is simply it's an act of will. Right? I'm either going to do as I'm told or I'm not going to do as I'm told. And that if I have enough willpower, I can make myself do what I want. Because the Ishbitz, we've learned many times, Meshelech, that it's a very small element of a very big picture, and that you can't really paint free will in really big brush strokes, and that in order for a person to fulfill the will of God, it needs to be connected. Not just connected to the Torah to know what the next thing is to do, but really connected in a deep way to be centered and to be whole and to be free. You know, If I if I leave my children alone in the house with a bag of potato chips, you know, and I say to them, on no condition are you to eat the potato chips, and I don't feed them, and I don't take care of them, and I don't keep on checking, you know, it's fairly predictable that at some point the potato chips are going to either eat themselves or they're going to get eaten, right? And, you know, it's okay for me to then shout at them and say, you know, you had free will, kids, and you made your own choices, and so I'm going to punish you. But the truth is, they didn't, really. Looking at it as a parent, you know, I can say pretty clearly that it was an illusion, their free will, that I could predict what choice they were going to make. I mean, they couldn't really make any other choice, right? They were hungry, and their children, you know. Really, free will, the exercise of free will requires freedom. And freedom requires very definite structure. For a person to be free, they have to be free of compulsions, right? Unless that's not freedom, you know, freedom, the Ishbitzer says when we tried to leave Egypt, we had to pass through a gateway called Piachiros, the mouth of freedom. And the idea was that no slave had ever left Egypt or run away from Egypt, because when they reached there, they realized, oh, you have all the license you want in Egypt. In Egypt, anybody could basically do what they wanted. So, on leaving Egypt, you were faced with the awful realization that you were going to leave Egypt and go to a place where you can't do what you want. So people would, even slaves would prefer to live in Egypt where there was license rather than go and live in a place where there was lots of structure, right? I mean, that was the idea. And when Pharaoh said to his people, you know, they're going to get there and they're going to realize that they're prisoners and they're going to come running back to me, that the Ishbitzer says that's what Pharaoh meant, you know, that the Jews would reach that place and they'd say to themselves, yeah, you know, we know what's going to happen. We're going to be given the Torah, we're going to be told what we can do every day, how we tie our shoelaces, what we can eat, you know. Let's go back to Egypt. In Egypt you could do what you want, right? But then Pharaoh doesn't really understand what freedom is, right? Freedom, to be free, you have to be free of compulsions, right? You have to be able to make your choices, right? Somebody who's constrained to act in a certain way, to smoke a cigarette, right? If when you wake up in the morning you have to smoke a cigarette, you're not free, right? And especially you feel it when you're running out of cigarettes and you find yourself getting in the car in the night, you know, to drive downtown to buy a pack of cigarettes, like, that's not freedom. You know? It's not even if you have no cigarettes, just realizing you're getting to the end of the box, right? And then there's not going to be any. Oh yeah, I may run out of cigarettes, right? That's enough to drive me out of the house to go buy another box. That's not freedom, right? Real freedom only comes when you really can make choices, right? Adult choices. Choices that are free of constraint. In order to do that, the Ishbitzer says, we had to have the Mishkan. We had to have this final this encampment with the Mishkan at the center and the Chaniyas at the Golem, the flags and the different tribes set up around it in a certain way. And we needed to have that in order for the Kedusha, in order for the holiness to be implanted in us so that we could follow the will of God, right? In other words, in order to follow the will of God, a person has to have done tremendous amount of work and also be part of a community that's dedicated to a certain way of life, and that's what makes it possible then to fulfill the Torah, right? One of the things that we were learning is that how come Avraham wasn't given the Torah? How come Moshe wasn't given? How come Yaakov, on his way down to Egypt, God didn't say to him, you know, you're going down to Egypt, you're going to need the Torah here, let me give you the Torah, right? How come it needed to have millions of people? You know, the 600,000 men between the age of 20 and 60, how come we couldn't receive the Torah until we had such vast numbers of people? It seems to make more sense to give the Torah to a small group, let them get used to it, everybody can teach their children and so on. Like, why would God wait until we were so many? And the answer is because every person has millions of needs. You know, from this one I need a smile. From this one, I need a salary. From this one, I need friendship. From this one, I need advice, right? From every person that you meet, you need something. And you can't really be expected to be dedicated to God unless there are a million people dedicated to you, right? We don't really become free until we become carefree. And you can't really become carefree so long as you have anxieties. And unless, I mean, if you know that there's a million people out there who are dedicated to taking care of your every need, then you don't have an anxiety if you really internalized it. Of course, then you become free to take care of the million needs that you are going to encounter in each person, right? So it wasn't until we were millions of people that we were really with one person. The Gemara says, it says, Vayichen Yisrael Neged Har, and the Jewish people camped by Mount Sinai. It doesn't say they camped, it says he camped. It's like we were like one person with one heart. At that moment, we were totally carefree because everybody walked around knowing, you know, that they could look after other people because there were other people looking after them. And it's only at that point that we become capable of really responding to the will of God, doing the will of God, and fulfilling and being fulfilled. Ki b'yitzias Mitzrayim, because when we came out of Egypt, lo yehoya rak shehasigu ha'oras Hashem Yisborach b'ri'iyah. We saw God, right? When we came out of Egypt, we were given insight, right? But it's, you know, it's sight. It has to do with seeing. But you know, by seeing God, you're not yet ready to follow God. As it's written in the Mechilta, the maidservant saw the sea, things, visions that were not vouchsafed to Ezekiel the prophet, right? But you know something? The maidservant and the sea didn't become Ezekiel. Right? Why? Because you can't become a prophet from seeing God. You can't become holy from seeing God. You can't become free of your compulsions by seeing God. Because seeing isn't enough. Because we were still, you know, even though we'd come out of Egypt for 7 days and we'd walked through the wilderness and we'd finally arrived at the Red Sea and we'd passed through the Red Sea in a miraculous way and we'd seen our enemies drowned in it and we'd seen, you know, God. We saw God, right? But we were still slaves. We didn't have free will yet. To really, to follow the light. Began by Matan Torah, and even though we stood at Sinai and we received the Torah and we said Nasa Vinishma will do and we'll listen and you know, there was nothing, we didn't feel that we were holding back. We felt that we were 100% committed to receiving and obeying and fulfilling the Torah. Afshinik for Belibam Dibri Torah, and even though God like carved the Torah into our hearts, still, it wasn't forever. It wasn't carved hard into that part of our hearts that is indelible. B'hakomas hamishkan, it's only when the tabernacle is erected. Nikva belibam la'umayad, that's when everything is fixed into our heart in a permanent way. Hi, Dr. Steve. And that's why the Jewish people didn't go from Egypt into the land of Israel. Because just in coming out of Egypt and seeing God at the Red Sea, and even after the revelation at Sinai, 49 days later, we still weren't ready because the holiness wasn't really fixed into our hearts. And at that time in the land of Canaan there were seven nations, and those seven nations represent the dark side of the Sefirot, of the seven lower Sefirot of Chesed, Gevura, Tiferes, Netzach, Hod, Yesod, and Malchus. We are learning today in Sefer Yetzirah in the eighth Mishnah of the first Perek, learning how everything in nature goes berotze v'shoif, everything goes to and fro, everything alternates, things flicker in and out of existence, and life itself, you know, is a dance where every particle, you know, dances on the edge of annihilation, in and out. And that represents, in a physical way, Rotze V'Shov, to and fro, that we see in the vision of Ezekiel, where he sees the angels, the Chashmalim, who look, Kemar HaBozek, they look like lightning, rushing to and fro. The word to and fro, we said, is also with desire and regret. And God creates the world with desire, and God's desire is, you know, permanent. But there has to be, in order for the world to work in an organic way, desire has to be balanced with regret. And the seven nations who occupy the land of Canaan, before we arrive there, they represent the element of those elements of the Sefirot that are represented with God's regrets. And so we don't really have, we the Jewish people, we don't really have what it takes to eliminate the dark side. Ulchein, Koyde Matan Torah V'Hakamas HaMishpat, before the revelation on Sinai, before the giving of the Torah and the setting up of the tabernacle, the Vishalai Nikva Kedusha B'Libam, because the holiness hasn't been fixed into their hearts, they couldn't conquer the seven nations. What does it mean to have holiness fixed into your heart? What is holiness? And the only way we can say, like in one phrase, what I heard from Shlomo, holiness is oneness. And what is the oneness? Understanding that Olam Nefesh and Shona, that the three elements of time and space and the soul, that they're all one. You know, that all time is now. That while we, you know, we live in a world where there's the experience of time moving from the past into the future, right? But really, we only ever live in now, and we don't really have a way of proving that there was a past or that there will be a future. You know, our experience is only ever now. We have all kinds of mathematical systems that we call science, whereby we can prove that there was such a thing as a past, without being solipsistic. But you know, we can't really imagine God in time, only in now. And the same applies for space. And everything is really just, there is only the one, there's the now, there's the here, and there's the us. And all the divisions that there are between us are really, you know, these are necessary for the world, in order for the world to operate, but they are an illusion. Because we are all inside and included in the one, in the imagination of God, right? If God is not in time and space, then neither are we. Kedusha is really understanding, really internalizing the oneness, right? It's not about separation or preparation. We can't get to Kedusha, we can't be centered until we have the makom, until we have the good place, the makom tov, which is what the Mishkan here in this week's Seder has come to represent. Ukamoy Kain, Ukoidim Shenechnesu La'aretz, before we came into the land, Tziva Hashem Yisborach, God commanded, Sheikvu Divrei Torah Kedusha B'Libam, that the Jewish people fix permanently the Torah and the holiness into their hearts, in order that they can conquer later these seven nations. Ukmoiken, and similarly, Mchuyiv Kol Odam. Now we bring it from the generation of the wilderness 3,500 years ago. Let's bring it back to us. Kmoiken, similarly, Mchuyiv Kol Odam. Every person has to have in their own life this awareness. Before you go into the promised land, before you leave the wilderness and go into the land of Israel, in other words, before you leave your meditation and go out there into the world of business, you have to fix the Torah into yourself. So that the holiness of the Torah will be there inside you. And then a person can then meet the challenges that he's going to face. And will be able to overcome that which needs to be conquered. So the story of the Jewish people coming out of Egypt, receiving the Torah, setting up the tabernacle, and then spending 40 years in the wilderness, this is really everybody. Each of us has in our life. We come out of Egypt, we have to come out of Egypt, we have to pass through the Red Sea, we have to turn our life over to God, and we have to learn the lessons, and we have to, we have to bow, we have to submit, we have to receive, we have to learn, we have to commit ourselves, and so on and so on. But we also have to have a place. We have to have a good place, a makom tov, into which everything is centered. And if we don't have that, we're not going to be able to move on. Umaamide hamokem hoyugesh kosmenori. Those who set up this good place are the three families, the three Levite families of Gershon Kosmenori, Moshe and Aaron ubonav, and Moshe and Aaron and his sons. Bnei Kohas. Those who are called in the Torah the sons of Kohath, Heim Bale Torah, these are the masters of the Torah, Shehoye Noise Oren, they're the ones who carried the ark of the raiders of the lost ark. Shehoye Yoidim Mishpat HaTorah, these are the people, what is the metaphor of carrying the ark? Means knowing what the Torah wants of you and how to respond. If somebody asks themselves, what am I supposed to do now? How am I going to keep Shabbos? How am I going to keep kosher? How am I going to daven? How am I going to give tzedakah? All the questions that a person can be faced with, in order to know the answer, you have to be a master of the Torah. This is the metaphor. It's just a metaphor, right? There is a family of Kohath, which we all have inside us, that knows what to do. Ubnei Gershon. Then there are the sons of Gershon. Himbali Yiro, these are the masters of the awe, the fear of God. The Fishoi Noisim Hayirios, they carried the tapestries, Shoi Kisulu Mishkan Kashamayim, which used to cover the Mishkan, the tabernacle, like the heaven covers the earth, right? Bahakrosim and the silver hooks that used to bind the tapestries together, showing the Roim b'Mishkan k'kochovim, which when you were inside the Mishkan, it looked like the stars. Zemiram is al yiro, the blue of the sky. I don't know if you've ever followed a police car. I don't know what they are in your state, but police cars here in Illinois, they have red lights and they have blue lights. One flashing blue light is worth 35 red ones flashing. Blue is fear. Blue reaches us in a way that red doesn't reach us. And the color tchelas, the blue wool, the Gemara says that blue is like the sky, and that's to remind us. The flashing blue light is much, much more noticeable than the flashing red light. Even though we use the red as danger and stuff because of the color of Gevura, right, and blue really the color of Chesed, but really, when you think about it, which is more penetrating, there is inside us, besides we have the know-it-all, who is the Bnei Kohath, we also have the Bnei Gershon inside us, who are always aware of heaven. even if they don't know what to do. You know, you don't have to be a great Talmud Chacham, you don't have to be a great scholar to be in awe of God, right? In fact, walk into any Beis Hamedrash, and you know, very often, the one who's in awe of God is not the Talmud Chacham, is not the rabbi, is a person who doesn't have all the book learning, right? And then there's the third element, Bnei Merori, Heim Bali Mitzvos Masim Tovim. Then you have the children of Merori, who are the masters of practical life. Shenosu Karshia Mishkan, they're the ones who carry the planks. Shemorim HaMitzvos Masim, you know, the planks, the wooden, the skeleton of the Mishkan. This is a hint at, you know, besides our intellectual prowess, besides our emotional and passionate response to God, there's the part of us that just serves God as we put on our shoes, as we go to work, as we, you know, as we are polite to the other driver on the highway, you know, I mean, as we get on with life, we do with derech eretz, right? We act like a mensch, you know, that is the Bnei Merori inside us. Sheish tekol echad mi'Yisrael asoga b'hem, everybody, every Jew, even if you don't have fear of God or awe, and even if you don't know what to do, but every person can be a mensch, right? Moshe Aaron and Bonav Heim Oyavei Hashem. So what do Moshe Aaron and his children represent? The lovers of God. What does it mean to be in love with God? It means always to be aware, to be looking. When you're looking at the person who gives you what you want, right? You know, when you're constantly aware of the person you love, that's love, right? And even though Moshe, he was a Baal Torah, he was the master of the Torah, he was the master of the fear of God, he was the master of the good deeds. So why we got all these different people representing? So the Ishbitzer says, yes, it's true that everybody has everything. But even though you and I may both have worship of God, right? We both love God, we both fear God, but each of us has different things that are prominent. The children of Kahas, it's Torah prominent, children of Gershon, fear is prominent, and with Moshe, it's the love of God which is prominent, and so on. So, just to sum up one last time, what the Ishbitz is saying is that until you have the Makom Tov, until you have a center in which you dwell, you're not really ready to tackle the world. And it doesn't matter how much commitment and enthusiasm you have to, you know, obeying the Torah, learning the Torah, fulfilling the Torah, and so on and so on. You know, it's not going to work until you're really grounded and centered, until you're free of compulsions. So now the Ishbitzer examines the phrasing. In the second Torah, the Torah tells us, "Noso Yisroish b'nei Gershon gam heim lebeis avoizim." Count the heads of the family of the sons of Gershon to their father's house. Also them, gam heim. Ha'inu chenema b'nei Gershon gam heim. Why does it say also them? Mishuna b'nei Kahas. It doesn't say that with the b'nei Kahas. It says count them. With the b'nei Kahas, it says count them. But here it says, count also them. There's somewhere implicit in that command to count them also is the Hava Amina. I might have said, maybe not, that God is commanding us to count them also. Because if God hadn't commanded us to count them, maybe I wouldn't. So the question is, why wouldn't I? What's the Hava Amina? What is the hypothesis that I might have put forward for not counting them? So he says like this, Kinosoi u'inyan hisnasis. The word counting in Hebrew, there are many other words that the Torah could use for counting. Most notably, pikida. The word nosoi has another meaning. The word anosi is a prince. Hisnasis, the whole concept of hisnasis is of, you know, primary leadership, like a royalty, right? Monarchy, you know, an elevation to the peerage is a nosi, right? So when the Torah, God says, Moshe, nosoi, count, it doesn't just mean count, it means elevate. So, b'nei kahasoi megim lisnasis. So the Ishbitzi says, it makes sense that the children of Kahas, the family of Kahas, they carry the Torah on their back, right? They're entitled to, you know, to be looked up to, to superiority, to a leadership role. Because what does it mean to carry the Torah on your back? The truth is that when you know anything about the Torah and people start to consult you on what's the right thing to do next, you find yourself almost constantly in gray areas. Sfeikos, doubts, right? Even the most simple magistrate or judge, you know, is constantly making judgment calls. Do I believe this person? Don't I believe this person? Should I punish this person? Should I reward this person? And, you know, you can make mistakes. I mean, that's implicit. So, do you refrain from making judgment calls because you may be wrong? You can't. Your job is to answer questions when you're asked. Right? That's your job. B'nei Kahas, who carry the Torah on their shoulders, in a sense, that's their role. And so, Magin Lisnasis, they're entitled to be elevated, because they're always putting themselves into that gray area, and to into testing, you know, places where they're tested. As it is written, Libnei Kahas Loi Nosan, the Bnei Kahas didn't receive any of the carriages, the carts, the ox carts, that their brethren used to carry the planks. But the Bnei Kahas didn't receive that, even though they carried some very heavy equipment and furniture. Because if you saw, they had to carry it on their shoulders, right? The Aron, the Ark of the Covenant, the Menorah, the gold altar, the table, and so on, these things had to be carried on their backs on staves, right? And that represents, like, that itself is a metaphor for the way they had to, their service, in the service of the Jewish people, they had to carry a lot of stuff on their shoulders. Ach b'nei Gershon, but the b'nei Gershon, they were different. Shechel kamho ye leyira, they were the masters of the fear of God, right? Lehistalik misfakers, and their way of worshiping God was not to go into any gray areas at all. B'chamokim shebo lenegdam dovashein abor, whenever they were faced with something that wasn't absolutely clear what they should do next, hoyeshev simla soisa, they didn't do anything. And so their whole life was without real anxiety. They never really got anxious about choices that they made because they didn't make choices. Or the choices that they made were always to err on the side of caution. They never gambled. You know something? Spiritually, if you don't gamble, you don't stand to win, right? If you're not ready to take a risk in the worship of God, you're only ready to do what somebody else is. You're always looking at the person next to you, see what they do, and then follow. There are no big prizes for following. Right? The prize is for creativity. Right? The prize is for going out there and doing what hasn't been done before. You know, worshipping God in a way that isn't copying somebody else. Going into yourself and entering those places where nobody's looked, where you haven't seen, you know, and finding your true essence, right? Gershon, that wasn't their way. Gershon said, you know, what did Daddy do? Whatever Daddy did, that's what I did. That's what I'm going to do. If I don't know what Daddy would have done in this situation, I won't do anything. You know, what the Ishbitz is saying is, I might have thought that is not even the Jewish way. Lefikach, therefore, the Torah tells us, count gamhem, also them. The Torah, God has to tell us explicitly, no, I want you to count the Bnei Gershon also, because that is also a spiritual path, because not all spiritual paths are appropriate for all people. And just because, you know, we think that you can't be a Jew without being creative, that's not so. There are people who can be Jews without being creative, just by doing what their father did, you know? And you know, one of the things that Zalman says, you know, is like, people today want the Torah. Everybody wants the Torah, even if they were never Orthodox, and even if they weren't brought up Orthodox, and everybody's like experiencing this hunger to reconnect with the texts. Where are we going to go for the texts? Who are you going to go to, right? You're going to go to the keepers of the text, right? Who is it? It's the Frommies, right? It's the Orthodox. Who's been learning the Gemara, the Zohar? Who's got it in their pocket, right? What have they done with it? Huh? They've just carried it, right? In a sense, the Frum world, the Orthodox world, is the Bnei Gershon, right? I'm not into innovation, right? I'm just going to do what my father did. And I'm just going to hand it over to my children. I'm going to teach them to do what I did, right? But you know what? They're here. And they still have this Torah, and anybody can go and take it, and it's there. It's available, right? So the Bnei Gershon, God says, Gamhem, you have to count them also. They are also entitled to his Hisnasis. This is also a leadership role. Kigam Lahem Savlonis. God says, you know what? They also suffer. They also have a burden on their shoulders. It's not so simple. It's not just Kahas who has the burden of making choices and so on. Gershon also has a burden. He also cares. Shesilkas and Misfakas, avoiding gray areas is also, it's also a difficult spiritual path. Vigam Lahem Magir Hisnasis. And they're also entitled to, you know, be counted as important. Ubnein Merori, when it comes to the third family, the children of Merori, Leinem and Nosi, that it doesn't say count in the sense of appoint a prince. There was no prince over that family, Fisher Oiskin, Bemitzes, Masses, because they were dealing with the practicalities, carrying the planks, which represents those elements of Judaism that we are all, we're all connected to, and we all have equally, and it's not this, it's not the cerebral, the intellectual, and it's not the, you know, the passionate devotional, it's what we do, and everybody's equal. L'chol Yisrael yesh lemasug b'mitzvos ma'asos, and every Jew knows what that's about. B'gam shem nosi shelo yehoyeh moir al zeh, and the name of the leader of the sons of Merari, his name is Tzuriel ben Avichael. Tzuriel, my God is a rock. Ben Avichael, my father is powerful. Sholem miftach oiz, because they never really had any doubt that what they were doing is the right thing. Sholem moitu, they knew that they couldn't be shaken. Vish also b'pshitus b'lisham sovi, because they just did what they needed to do. B'bnei Kohas b'nei Merori, when it talks about the two sons, Kohas and Merori, Nema b'yad Moshe, it says, and they were counted at the hand of Moshe. With Gershon, they never be at Moshe. But when it talks about counting the family of Gershon, it doesn't say at the hands of Moshe. Ki Moshe Moira Chachma Mevureres, because Moshe, the idea of Moshe, and this is something that we've been learning since the middle of the book of Exodus, Moshe is also a metaphor for the finest, the highest level of Chachma, wisdom, the Sefira of knowing intuitively what to do, coming, you know, something from nothing, right? This is the level of Moshe which is inside each one of us, the level of Chochmah. B'kavona l'shem shemaim, and true knowing l'shem shemaim, you know, what you're doing is for the sake of God, right? So Kahas, in his Torah learning, and Merori, in his simple practice of the mitzvahs, they both are connected to Chochmah and to l'shem shemaim, for the sake of heaven. But not so Gershon, you know, because, you know, the Ishbitz says Bnei Kahas hoye tekufis mamashe kavanosim hoye toiv. The Bnei Kahas always had this confidence in what they were doing because they were learning the Torah. They were applying the Torah, you know, in a rabbinical way, as an exegesis, and whatever they were doing, they were developing the Torah to fit, you know, changing times, and they were carrying the Torah, right? Libnei Merori and the children of Merori, Tekufis, they were always confident. Mashai Simasa, they were getting tzedakah, they were getting up in the morning, making brochas and davening, and doing what they were supposed to do. Ach Bnei Gershon, but that the sons of Gershon, that the Torah tells us, count them also, because that's also a way of worshipping God. It doesn't say that they were counted by Moshe, because that's Midas Hayira, it's fear. Right, in the desire to stay out of the gray area and not get involved in controversy and not be too, you know, not be creative and not to use your initiative and just do what your father, you know, you can fool yourself very easily into believing that you're doing the will of God and that you fear God, that you are in awe of God. Ze'ena mevura, but that's not so clear. In that way, in actual fact, it's the riskiest way of all. Because naysaying, saying no, can very easily become a religion in itself. Maybe you're procrastinating, right? Maybe your desire is just to, your desire for safety is because you're just too lazy to take risks, right? There are so many ways that the way of Gershon can be not holy. So it doesn't say that they were counted by Moshe. And then afterwards, then there's like a final coda in which it says all of them were counted by Moshe. Because, you know, even those things that are not so, they're also so. You know, the sons of Gershon were very holy. The Torah doesn't want to, like, you know, talk down at them. Just, it wants to point out to us that when we are being extra careful, we think we are being extra careful, but from the other point of view, we're being cautious. And cautious, you know, is not always a good thing. It's not always a good thing. It's easy to fool yourself into thinking that you're doing the will of God when you're being cautious. And very often, all you're doing is protecting your own something. So we have time just quickly to look at the next. So, once the Mishkan was established and set up, then the camp had to become holy. In order to, for the camp, meaning the whole 12-mile encampment, to become holy, there were different levels. There was the level of the Mishkan itself, which was the Holy of Holies, and then around it was the Machne Leviyah, and then around it was the Machne Yisroel, the camp of the Jews. And there were certain people who had to leave the Mishkan, and there were certain people who had to leave the Levite camp, and then there were certain people who had to be sent out all the way from the Jewish camp and were not allowed into the camp of the Jewish people. Let them send from the camp, it says, V'yishlechu min ha-machne kol tzeruah v'chol zov v'chol tomei le-nefesh, every leper, every zov, and everybody who's come in touch with death. So the Ishbitz says, tzeruah, what is the metaphor of the leper, hukas? Leprosy, in ancient times, we know it's not Hansen's disease that we have in medical books, but it was like a spiritual blemish that appeared as a physical sign on the skin. But what is it to us? You know, we have our place, right? We make our makom tov, we make our special place inside us where we can be centered and from which we can then work our way outwards to deal with the world, right? But we have to have that place inside us which is holy, where we dwell, where the Shechina dwells, where we go, you know, to reconnect, right? We have to send out from all the camps, we have to send out the leper, right? The leper wasn't allowed anywhere in that 12 square mile camp. He had to go outside shouting, "Tummy, tummy, unclean, unclean." Right? So the Ishbitz says, what is that? That's a metaphor for rage. Somebody who speaks Lashon Hara. Why do we speak Lashon Hara? Because we're enraged. When somebody speaks Lashon Hara, it's like killing somebody. Right? Character assassination. Why would I assassinate somebody? I'm enraged, right? Zav is somebody who has like a discharge from their sexual organs, right? So what is that a metaphor? Baltava, somebody who is overcome and riddled with lust, right? V'tami l'nefesh. What is tami l'nefesh? Means somebody who's come in touch with death. Hu atzvus. That is a metaphor for depression. So the Ishbitz says, let's have a look and see what the Torah says. Hatzarua nishtalach mishalosh machnez. The leper has to go out all three camps. Kimidas kas ein lechelik b'Yisrael. Because rage has no place in Israel. You can't be a Jew worshipping God while you're enraged. If you're experiencing rage, you're not just not in the center, you're not in the outside, and you're not in the area. You're completely in another place, right? Hazav, the person who is like overcome and riddled with his lusts, right? Mishtalach rak mimachne levia. He's allowed into the camp of Israel, among the 12 tribes, but he's not allowed into the inner camp of the Levites. Umimachne shchina, also of course not allowed into the central sanctuary. Hainu kimidas hatava, because lust and licentiousness, lo yos l'tamid chachamim, es pasnisht. It's inappropriate. Everybody has a little, but you know something? If you want to get into that place of your center, you have to get past that. Tomil nefesh, and then the person who has come in touch with death, which we said is atzvus, it's depression. Eile mishtalach rak mimachne shechina, is allowed into the Israelite camp, and then is allowed into the Levite camp, is only not allowed into the central sanctuary. Because you know something, unfortunately, all of us at one time or another have a little bit depression. You know, sometimes it's the Torah itself which depresses us. Rusche calls it heat. The Gemara says it's the Torah that makes them so hot, the rabbis. You know? But that heat then leaves us with depression, right? And so the person who is depressed cannot enter the sanctuary. Why? Because to enter the sanctuary inside the self, where the divine is, where the divine dwells, to enter into the tabernacle inside every person they have inside them, that makom tov, the good place, the place where you can center yourself in time and space, that place where you can be the high priest going into the Holy of Holies on Yom Kippur, right? That place inside yourself, which we have been talking, that it required these 17 weeks of 17 sedras from Parshas Truma all the way here, because this is the journey, and this is the place that you're going to have to get to before you're ready to go out into the world and conquer the seven nations of the dark side of the Klipa, right? What is the key? The key, you have to get rid of your chaos, you have to get rid of the rage. That's like basic. You can't even like be a Jew if you have that murderous rage that can assassinate somebody, right? And you have to get over past your lusts, right? But then finally, you have to get past the depression, right? Because in that place, in that divine place, there is only joy. Oiz v'chedvu. Joy and glee. If you're not there, you can't be in that divine place. And in fact, being in joy and glee, being besimcha, right, is being in that divine place. Shain, thank you. Thank you for